All right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Mem Bet Amud Bet by the Mishnah. The Mishnah begins, Amudar ha-na'ami chaveiro, person who is restricted in getting benefit from his friend, lo yashilenu, he may not lend objects to him, v'lo yishal mimenu, and may not borrow objects from that individual, lo yalvenu, he may not lend him money, v'lo yalvim mimenu, and he cannot borrow money from him. And over here, the Ran makes a distinction that's important. Is what is the difference between she'ila and halva'a? And the Ran says, she'ila she'icha b'mide d'hadr b'eine. You use the terminology she'ila when it's something that returns intact. Ve'alva'a she'icha b'mide lo d'hadr b'eine. And halva'a is a terminology that's used when it's something that is not returned intact, meaning that the value is returned, but not the object itself. So one is a loan, and one is borrowing, and that's the distinction here between hashala and halva'a in the Mishnah. V'lo yimkor lo, he cannot sell items to him. V'lo yikach mimenu, and he can't purchase from him. So now, in this case, it's interesting and difficult, the Mishnah, and that's what the Gemara is going to discuss, which is why is there a two-way restriction? Or here you have one individual is restricted in getting hana'ah from the other party, then the restriction should only be in a single direction, which is the party who is the one restricted in getting the hana'ah, should therefore not be able to receive credit from the other party, may not be able to borrow from the other party. But for him to lend money, or for him to lend out an object, there shouldn't be any issue. The Mishnah has three different cases over here, and in each of the cases, we say that there's a two-way street. There's a problem in both directions, and obviously the question is, why is it that there is a problem in both directions? So where it says, Bishlama lo yalvena, I understand why he can't lend to him the kamahanile. When you extend him credit, then you're giving him a benefit. Extending him credit, lending him money, is giving a benefit. Ela lo yalvem himenu, my kamahanile. Why can't he borrow money from this individual? This individual is restricted in getting enough from him. Why can't he borrow money from him? We're talking about in a situation where there's no interest that's paid. So therefore, all he's doing is taking money, he's giving the money back. There's nothing earned in the interim. Why can't he borrow the money from him? There is no hana'ah simply by him lending out that money. Ubishlama. Now the Gemara moves and says, Bishlama lo yalvemenu. Maybe I could understand the case why he can't borrow from him. Lo yikachemenu. And why he can't purchase from him. Because the kemetani mine. Because he's getting hana'ah. Aval lo yishalemenu. But you can't borrow from him. My kemetani mine. What type of hana'ah is there? Now, over here, the Rishonim take different approaches as to what the issue is and why the Gemara over here moves from a general question about the Mishnah as to why there is a two-way street over here. Why is it that the person who's mudar hana'ah can't borrow both money, can't borrow an object, and can't be purchasing items? Over there, we understand because he's getting hana'ah. But in the reverse, why can't he lend money to that party? Why can't he lend objects to that person? Why can't he sell things to that person? All of those situations, he's not getting hana'ah. It's the other party that's getting hana'ah, and there's no restriction in that case. So the Gemara asks that as a general question. Then the Gemara carves out and says that by halva'ah and by mekach u'memkar, I understand the situation. So now, we'll go through each one of those, why that is the case. So the Rishonim here say that the bidochak, you can explain by the case of halva'ah, that there is a possibility of hana'ah that comes about, which is that if the individual lends you money, and then you return the money, even though you're returning the exact same value, in their day, you could return different coins. And since you could possibly return better coins than you borrowed, then there's a possibility of generating hana'ah for the lender. So again, of course, you can't extend credit to this individual, because that is giving him hana'ah. But even borrowing from him can result in hana'ah to that party, if you borrowed money, and then return coins that are in better condition or better quality than the ones that you borrowed. In the case of a mekach u'memkar, it's clear that if he is buying something from you, okay, that is something where he gets hana'ah. Why is it that the other way around, when he's selling something to you, it's also hana'ah? So there, the Tosafot, the Balei Tosafot, the Rosh, have an approach that we're talking about here, is zvina mitziyah. We're talking about normal transactions, something that's sold at the market price between the two parties, and their shita, as we've seen before, is that then both parties get hana'ah from it. Since both parties get hana'ah from it, then it's equally problematic, both for the buyer and the seller over here, because both parties are benefiting from this transaction. and embedding from that transaction, that's why we understand why you would have both sides be asur over here. Whether he's a buyer or a seller, then we understand the problem. Now, obviously, in the instance where he says, avalim kolor beyoter, mutar. But if he's willing to sell above market, and he's willing to buy below market, then that individual certainly can transact, because then it's clear that you prevented the hana'ah from taking place. Because then the benefiting party, who's the one that's not the mudar b'hana'ah, if he sells high and buys low, then he's the beneficiary, and the other party is never a benefiting party, and therefore it'll work out fine. But here in the Mishnah, we're talking about a case where they're buying at market, and therefore both parties are getting hana'ah here. That's why the Gemara says, Bishlamo, I understand the cases of transactions. I understand the case of halva'ah because of those two sides to the puzzle. But what I don't understand is the case of hashalah. I don't understand the case of lending. Why is it by lending that there's a two-way street? Over there, you don't have any reason to believe that there is hana'ah on both sides of the ledger. And therefore, why should it be that I can't borrow something from a person who's mudar hana'ah from me, Manny? First, I understand why I can't lend them an object, because they're restricted in getting hana'ah. But on the other hand, why can't the individual borrow from them? What hana'ah do they get by lending out the object? It's actually to their detriment. They lend out the object, and then they get it back. Yes, they get the object back, but it's used. It's depreciated. So it's even worse than they got when they lent it out. So there's no hana'ah over there, and why should that be problematic? That's the question of the Gemara at this point. The Ran has a slightly different approach here with regards to the Zvina. He says, we're talking about here a case. Says the nearly the mashma the matnitin bezvina harifa. And the case in our Mishnah is a case where you're talking about merchandise that is hot in the market, something that can be sold easily. And that's why the Gemara over here is asking the question of why is it by Yimkor and Likach, why isn't it an even playing field? Because it's a case where it's something that sells by itself. Since it's something that sells by itself, the seller it doesn't get any hana'ah, the buyer gets all the hana'ah. So in this case, if the buyer is taking it off the hands of the person who's mudar hana'ah, then the seller is getting absolutely no hana'ah over here. So why should that be problematic? And that's the nature of the question of the Gemara over here. So that's now the Gemara says, okay, that's why I have a question. If it was a zvina mitziah, like Tosafot and the Rosh say, I wouldn't have a question here at all. But now that it is zvina de charifa, I don't understand why one of the parties here is restricted in any way from selling this object to another party when he's mudar hana'ah. And seemingly in the Ran's girsa over here, he assumes that there's only one question of the Gemara. The one question of the Gemara is, I understand why lo yashilenu, lo yelvenu, velo yimkor lo. I don't understand the other half of all these situations. I don't understand the respect of lo yishal mimenu. I don't understand velo yelven mimenu. I don't understand lo yikach mimenu. So his explanation of Mekach u'Memgar makes it that, again, it's a lopsided situation in which I don't understand. If it's Zvina Harifa, then the Mocher is not getting any benefit. The buyer is getting all the benefit. And if that's the case, I understand why Lo Yimkor Lo, you can't sell it to him because he's Mudar hana'ah and he'll be the buyer and getting all the benefit. But why Lo Yikach Mimenu? Why can't I buy from him? If the buyer is getting all the benefit and the seller is getting no benefit, when he's the seller, his Neder hana'ah should have no impact over here. So according to the Ran, it's one broad question. There isn't two stages in the Gemara like the Tosafot and the Rosh suggest, which the Gemara asks the question and then says at least in two of these we can figure out a reason to say that it is a two-way street. Okay, then the Gemara answers, Amar Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, Kagon, Shenadru Hana'ah Zemizeh. It's a case where the Isur Hana'ah is in bidirectional. That means both parties took neder of Isur Hana'ah from each other. And that explains our Mishnah now. Why can't you go in either direction? It's because both parties are serene b'hana'ah. The Ran asked the question, Ma'i chidush? What's the chidush anymore? If both parties are serene b'hana'ah, of course you can't borrow in either direction. Of course you can't buy and sell. Of course you can't lend in either direction. There's no question here. So he says, V'chitayim imkein ma'ika mashvalan, nira d'stamlan ki Rabbi Eliezer. Teaching us, the Mishnah is now stam like Rabbi Eliezer, who we saw earlier. Again, some stam Mishnayot like him, which is the vitur asur b'mudar hana'ah. Even small things like this, which are vitur, are still considered to be hana'ah and problems with regards to the nether. They are significant enough hana'ah that it causes you issues with your iser hana'ah or the nether hana'ah that you've taken, and therefore be disqualified. So that's what the Ran says. The Chiddush is, if both of them took nidarim, the Mishnah is only teaching us that small things like this, according to Rabbi Eliezer, are problematic, And that's why it's restricted over here. The alternate answer is the Bayamar, Gzeira Lish'ol Mishum Lahash'il, Vechenu Bechulu Gzeira. The Gzeira here is because Lish'ol Mishum Lahash'il. We don't let you borrow because you might lend. And the same is true by all the others. Now, the Rosh says over here that that's Lav Davko. Habakulon is Lav Davko. The Lokoy Yelve. It's only talking about the loan issue. As far as the Rosh is concerned, Mekach u'Memkar, we have a clear answer to why the Mishnah answers both sides, is because it's a Zvina Mitzio. It's a Zvina that sits in the middle. And since it's a Zvina that sits in the middle, both parties are beneficiaries. And in that case, that's why it's Asur. So leave that out of the picture, the Rosh says. Now, Abaye gives us an answer with regards to Hashalah. By borrowing, what's the issue? That if we let you borrow, then you might come to lend to him. If you lend to him, then you're clearly giving him Hana. So we don't let you borrow because you might come to lend. The same is true, he says, with regards to Halva'a. We did give an answer about Halva'a, but it was an answer that was Dachuk, which said that maybe he'll borrow money and return to him coins that are better than he borrowed, and he'll be giving Hana to the individual. Now, instead, we're going to go with Abaye's explanation and say, we don't let you borrow money because you might come to lend money. Extending credit to this individual is giving him Hana, so that's problematic. Borrowing from him, okay, that's not problematic, but borrowing might lead to lending, and therefore we restrict it. That's the way that the Rosh reads it, and that's the way that the Baalei HaTosafot read it. The Ran, on the other hand, reads this applicable to all three cases, which is that in all three of these instances, it's Atuha, which is that we don't allow you to borrow because you might lend. We don't allow you to borrow money because you might extend credit, and we don't let you buy even Zvina Harifa, even something that sells itself, and you're not giving this guy any hana'ah because you're the buyer. We don't let you do this because of the other way around. Maybe that you will buy something that is either a la pay, something that's not good to sell and something that's not easily sold, or that you might sell him something that's Zvina Harifa, and therefore the statement of a buyer applies to all three of these instances. And that's because the Ran sets up the case of Mekach u'Memkar in a case where it's clear that there's only one beneficiary, and that's the buyer and not the seller. So here when the buyer gets the hana'ah, there's no problem. So why would we restrict that? Why would we restrict him in that instance? We restrict it because of the reverse situation, which is that either he might sell to this individual Zmina Harifa, or that he might actually buy from him something that is not a hot item or an easily bought item. And because of that, we worry about it. So according to the Ran, you have all three of these instances, the Chuin Bekulu Gezeira, the application of Abaye is to all three of the instances in the Mishnah. Now, the Baalei HaTosafot and the Ran raise an issue, which is, we had a Mishnah earlier in the Masechta where a person says that he restricts himself from getting Hana from Israel, any Jew. So there we said that he's allowed to transact with Jews, he just has to buy at a high price and sell at a low price. That way he's sure he's not getting Hana from Jews. So why don't we go Zeratu over there? Our Gemara here says we don't allow you to transact with this individual because if we let you transact, even when there's no Hana, we're afraid of you coming into a situation where there is Hana. So why don't we say the same thing earlier? And again, there's a Mishnah later on, which similarly has no Gzeira like this, where we only answer it in one direction, not in the other direction. So the Ran wants to know, why is it that it's not a standard in all of these Mishnayot that we don't allow these bilateral transactions because of the problem? One way is problematic, the other way is not. We don't allow the other way because it might come to the one that is problematic. Yet we have these other instances where we don't worry about that. So he quotes B'Shem HaRamban, Dehotam Kevin de Mikulu Yisrael Nadar Lo Gazrin in Alei. That earlier on in the Masechta, when there he takes the nether from Kol Yisrael, over there we're not gozer on him because it's going to cause him tremendous difficulty. If we block him from transacting with Jews, then he's going to only be able to transact with non-Jews, and it's going to be put him into a very, very difficult position. So in that instance, we weren't gozer. Over here, where the nether now is only from a single individual, to restrict him in bilateral transactions, that's fine. Because if we restrict him this guy, he'll transact with the other guy, with another person. It's not an issue. It's one person. That's not create a huge amount of inconvenience. So over here, they put a Gzeira together. Whereas by the case earlier, they did not put a Gzeira in place because of that. In addition, the Ran goes on to explain that in that case coming up in the Mishnayot, where it seems, again, there is a single individual, and still there's no Gzeira Atu. There he says the difference is that, T'chi Gazrin and Hocha, Hani Mili B'Hani L'Chud. That over here, when we do this, it's only in these instances, D'Taninan B'Matnitan, D'Lo Mashmal Hula Inche, D'Litzeru B'Mudar Hana'a. Because these are things that people normally wouldn't assume are covered by the Isurei Hana'ah. And since these are things that are not normally covered, the person wouldn't expect to be problematic, that's where we're gozer. So we're gozer in the direction that's mutar in order to prevent the tzad that is asur. So the Ran says there are two qualifications in order to have this gzera come into place. One is that it has to be limited, so that doesn't cause the guy tremendous inconvenience or difficulty in maintaining the neder. And number two is it has to be a chiddush of sorts, which is not that it would be automatically that you assume there's a problem over here, but there is some chiddush here about the fact that we are gozer. If both of those things are true, then we'll be gozer. If those both are not true, then we would not be gozer. Tosafot, on the other hand, says that the distinction over here between why over here we're gozer and by the cases, other cases we're not gozer, is the difference between hashalah and the other cases. Remember the Ran said over here that all three cases in our Mishnah are gzerah, including mekach u'memkar. Therefore, the Ran has to explain all the other cases of mekach u'memkar, like the Mishnah earlier and the Mishnah later. How come over there there's no gzerah? Tosafot does not have to explain that because he thinks that mekach u'memkar in a case in our Mishnah is zvina mitzia. So that's not part of the gzerah. That's a sur because both parties are beneficiaries. The things that have gzerot in our Mishnah are the cases of hashalah and halva'ah. So what Tosafot has to explain is why is hashalah different than mekach u'memkar? Why by Hashalah do we say there is a Gzerah, and by Mekach u'Memkar we do not say that there is such a Gzerah? So Tosafot brings, V'nir el-Aram, derigilo tu, k'shadam mash'il l'chaveiro, sh'chaveiro mash'ilo, yoter mishar dvarim. That there is a somewhat of a quid pro quo here, that when you lend something to someone, people lend you things back. And there's some sort of, you scratch my back, I scratch your back, which is that if you lend objects or items to an individual, they will also do the same for you. So because of that, there's this natural affinity between the parties that will generate the exchange of items, and that's why we have to be gozer by hashalah. And you could argue the same thing by halva'a. You could argue the same thing by halva'a, which is that if you extend credit to this individual, they will also extend credit back to you in times when you're in need. So there, in those situations where these are things where people are providing a service or a benefit to the other party, we assume that the recipient party will also do the same in return. And that's why we put it there in place. By Mekach u'Memkar, there's no reason to put that in place because Mekach u'Memkar is exactly that. It's a transaction. If you're doing a transaction, then you don't assume that the person has to transact with you again or in the opposite direction just because you transacted with them beforehand or in another direction. So that's how Tosafot distinguishes between the case of Hashalah and maybe Halva'ah. In other cases, the Rashash mentions the case by Halva'ah, that maybe Halva'ah is actually also explained by our Mishnah because, in general, when people are taking a neder anah from another person, it assumes that they don't like them, or they have some altercation with the individual that they don't want to provide anah to them. So then, when he extends credit to the individual, it's almost like there's a thawing of the frozen relationship between them, and therefore it signals or it shows you that there is hana'ah over here. And because of that, we won't let you both lend money to the individual, which clearly is hana'ah, but even borrow from the individual money, because borrowing from that individual indicates a sort of easing of the tension between the parties, and that hana'ah itself might be problematic. Okay, so just in summary, we have here, according to the Tosafot and the Rosh, Mekach u'Memkar, it's obvious why both parties are benefiting over here, because it's a zvina mitziyah. The question of the Gemara is with regards to Halva'ah, which we gave a difficult answer about the larger coinings be returned, and Hashalah, clearly over there, by lending objects that there makes no sense as to why there's a duality or a back and forth that is Asur. And we answered either because they're both Asur Bana to each other, or because as Abai says, it's a Gzera Otu. And therefore the Gzera Otu applies to Hashalah, and Gzera Otu applies to Halva'ah. And why do we have the Gzera there and not by Mekach u'Memkar? Because there's a natural order or affinity between parties that lend to each other or borrow from each other that they will do the same in kind back. According to the Ran, we're talking about here a case where it's a Zvina de Harifa, and therefore the Gemara's questions are equally across the board by all of these questions. Whether it's Mekach u'Memkar, whether it's Hashalah, whether it's Halva'ah, that makes no sense why there's a two-way street over here. And for that, the answer to the Gemara is either the Isra Hana'ah is in both directions, there's a nether on both sides, as the Ran said before, the Chiddush is the Vitor is Asur, like Rabbi Eliezer, or like Abaye, that it's Gezer Otu. And therefore, according to the Ran, Gezer Otu applies to all three cases of the Mishnah. Gezer Otu is by Mekach u'Memkar, by Hashalah, and by Halva'ah. How do we distinguish that from the other cases earlier by Mekach u'Memkar, where we don't make such a Gezerah? So we saw that the Ramban the Ran quotes over here, makes a difference between when you have an Isser Anah from one individual versus multiple individuals, or really the whole Klal Yisrael, where it'll be impossible if we put the Gzera in place. And also, it has to be something that's a Chiddush, that the Mishnah is teaching you something where people would not have assumed it's Asur. So therefore, we have to put the Gzera in place in order to protect against people coming to the Isser Anah, which they might not even think is a problem of Isser Anah. Okay, the next Mishnah begins. Amalo, Hashileni Paratcha. Please lend me your ox, your cow to plow with. Amalo, Eina Pnuya. It's not available right now. I'm using it. It's not available. Amar Kunam Sadi Shani Choreshba. He says that I make it a sur to plow with this ox or this para in my field, the olam, forever. He basically is upset at this individual. That's the way most of the Rishonim explain this. You can see that in Rashi. V'nitatzeva shuel k'neged ha-mashil. He got upset at him that he's not lending him the para, and he thinks that he's just playing games and he's not lending to him. So he says, I don't want your para anyway. I am making it a sur for me to plow my field with your para whatsoever. Then, all of a sudden, the lender shows up and says, you know what? You can have my para. In the end, I realized I didn't need it, or now it's available, and now you can have it. So now the guy's stuck. He took a nether that he can't utilize it. So what's the din? If it was his way to do the harisha, meaning that he did it himself, who asur v'kol adam mutarim, and everybody else is mutar. So in this case, as Rashi says over here, ro'im imhu prazi. We check out if he's a villager, if he's a farmer, he's a guy who does his own plowing. He's a guy who mows his own lawn. He takes care of his own lawn. He's a guy who plows his own fields. So he plows his own fields, and he took this nether, then his nether clearly applied to himself, because that's what he had in mind. As the Ran says over here, kilefi rigilut kivein lidor. The way that a person normally acts, that's the intent of his nether. So if he planned on plowing himself, when he took the nether, then it was about himself, not about anybody else plowing. Therefore, he can't plow with cow or this ox in his field, but someone else could do that on his behalf. V'meidar kol achrosh, if he normally does not plow the field, meaning that he hires people to mow his lawn, he hires people to plow his fields, then hu v'chol adam asurim. The gersa that we have in our mission is that he is restricted, and so is everyone else. I mean that he can't plow the field whatsoever, because that's the normal way. If you look in the Rosh had an alternate girsa, which was, v'meidar kol achrosh, hu mutar v'chol adam asurim. So he has an alternate girsa over here, which is that in a case where he does not normally plow, then only other people are restricted, and he's not restricted, because he doesn't normally plow. So when he had the nether in mind to say, I'm not going to plow my field with this shore, this ox, he had in mind those people that normally plow his field for him. He didn't have in mind for himself to do it. So therefore the Ran says he is mutar, the Rosh says that he is mutar, and the others are surim. The Gersa that we have in our mission is that they're all asurim. Other people are surim, and so is he asur. I mean that his nether incorporates both himself and other parties. The Rosh has this interesting Gersa, which suggests that he would be mutar, because he only had in mind those other people that normally do the plowing on his behalf. All right. Amudar hana'a mechaviro. Person who takes a nether that he would not get hana'a from his friend. Ve'en lo ma yochal. And he has nothing to eat now. He's in a bind. He doesn't have anything to eat. So this other individual who cannot give him hana'a, what can he do in order to help out his friend who's in desperate needs or in desperate straits right now? He can go, holeich etzel chavani v'omer. He goes to the local grocer, the local marketplace, Omer. Ish ploni mudar mimeni hana. That individual is restricting getting hana from me. Ve'eni yodea ma'ase. And I don't know what to do for him. Ve'hu notein. The chenvani can go ahead and now give food to that individual. Uvam and tell me zeh. And then he can come and collect the value or the payment from the individual who is situations where person doesn't have what to eat, and we'll see that the Mishnah allows for other instances where we will allow it, but we have limitations in using this dispensation here, and it's limited to cases where the person is really in desperate straits or really needs your help. So in those instances, we will allow it, otherwise we will not allow it. Number two is, in this case, the individual can't say directly to the chenvani, please give him food and I will pay you. Because if that's the case, he becomes a shliach, then the chenvani becomes an agent of that individual. And it's as if he's giving hana directly, because he's just having someone else do it on his behalf. But if doing it on his behalf, it's as if he's giving hana to the individual, and it doesn't work. So the only way this works is basically by not appointing him a shliach, but having the guy figure it out on his own, and then act on his own volition to give this guy, and then come back and collect from the party who is not allowed to grant hana to the recipient. So that's the way that it works, because if he establishes him as a shliach, it won't work. So anybody who says, kol hazan einu mafsid, that would work as well, because there he's not appointing anybody a shliach. Or in this case, where he explains the difficult situation, and the chanveni figures it out on his own, it's allowed. But if he says that to an individual, kol hashomei oti yizon oto, anybody who hears me should feed him, that's already called shlichut, and we wouldn't allow that to go through. So it has to be clear that he's not creating an agency to the chenvani. And part of the chiddush of the Mishnah here is the fact that it's a chenvani that he knows. It's a chenvani that he's familiar with. And because it's a chenvani he's familiar with, the chenvani normally extends him credit and knows that this guy generally pays. Despite the fact that the chenvani knows him well and has a relationship with him, we still do not consider it. We don't deem it to be shlichut. We don't deem it to be agency. And that's why it's the chiddush over here that we allow it to go through. Now, the most important factor, and the Rosh and the Tosafot both say this, im yirtze letet lo, aval mishum achi enu chayev letet lo. Both of them say this, that after the chenvani gives food to that party that needs it, and he goes back to collect the money from the person who told him about the predicament, he cannot force him to pay. He cannot demand pay for it. He has no way to get the payment out of him. Why? Because if he can get the payment out of him, then he's already a shliach. Then he's already an agent, and that means that it's not done in a way that is preventing the giver from giving the recipient hana'ah. The only way we can do that is by putting someone in the middle who the giver is not obligated to pay, and the person in the middle is not obligated to give the other party this generous benefit. So because he's not chayav to reimburse him for that, that's why when he does reimburse him, then there's no problem, because then he's not granting hana'ah yashir, or he's not using him as an agent to get money to this other party. Now, that's interesting only because in both of them say yimitze. Now, why that's interesting is because in American law today, that's not the case. In American law today, I mean, at least historically, today you can't differentiate in the law between these, but historically the development of the law went through, there was a court of law and what they call the court of equity. Court of equity is that when sometimes there's no contract between parties and there's no official agreement between parties, but the equitable solution is to obligate the party because it's clear that the other individual acted because of what the other party said. It's called promissory estoppel. And over here, the reason that the chenvani gave money to the other party is because of what this individual told him. The individual told him, I'm mudar hana'ah, I can't give him the money, and now what do I do? It's clear here that he's making a proposal to this individual that if you take care of it, I'll pay you back. So under American law, you could actually go to court, and the chenvani could actually extract the money from that individual because he relied. And it was a reasonable reliance on what he said to grant the food to the person who was mudar hana'ah. And therefore, the party that's not allowed to grant him hana'ah would now be obligated to pay. So that might cause a problem, because if he's obligated to pay, now it creates a shlichut in a sense. Now, you could say that it's different, because they're only doing that because it's an equitable solution. We're not really saying that that's the real law. The law would have been that he's not obligated because there's no contract, there's no agreement between them. But to get to an equitable solution, we say that the guy has to pay. But that fact that it's obligated under American law is interesting, because it's not similar to what would happen over here, and actually might cause a problem. And under American law, I may not be able to use this methodology for getting around the problem, because under American law, you probably would be chayav, obligated to pay the chenvani who put out money based on the story and the situation that you described to him. All right, so now the Gemara says, Hayav beito livnot, gidro the gedor. So now he had his house to build, or his fence to put up, sadeo liktzor, or he had his field to harvest. This person goes to the workers. Omer, ish ploni mudar mi meni hana. This individual is restricted in getting hana from me. I don't know what to do. The poalim go and work for this individual without saying anything. And then they come and collect their wages from the individual who told them the story or told them the predicament. Again, it has to be a case where the poalim have no recourse. They can't force him to pay. It's only if the guy so chooses to pay. If he says, I'm not paying in the end, they're out of luck in that case. So that's why it works over here, because again, he's not acting as the poalim and not acting as shlichim, but rather acting on their own independent right to go in and do the work. And then when they come to claim the money from the party who told him about the predicament, if he wants to give them money, that's his choice. And since it's his choice, he's not obligated to give it. It's not as if he's giving direct hana'ah to the recipient party. They were walking together together, they're traveling together, these two individuals, and that guy is Mudarna from the other party. And now he has nothing to eat. They're out in the desert, they're traveling, and he has nothing to eat. What he does is the other people that are traveling with him, he gives them the food or whatever item it is as a gift. And then the other party now is mutar in it. So again, here you have a real emphasis by Tosafot and the Rosh that this is only in this predicament. Only in this situation where it's a shantat chak, do we allow you to do such a thing? Because the guy's basically going to starve if he doesn't get food at this point in time. And everybody has limited resources in this caravan. And this one guy who has excess resources, he's able to give to him, but he can't give it directly. If he gives it directly, then he's giving him mana. So how does he do it? He gives it indirectly by giving it to a third party. And then that third party grants it to the party who needs it. By doing that, pushing it through a third party, it's mutar. Now outside, and most of you shouldn't believe, outside of this circumstance, we wouldn't let you do this. Even though technically this should work in any situation. If you give it to a third party, then you really have a way to get around the problem of giving direct hana. Because you're giving it to the third party, and then the third party grants it to the one who's mudar hana. So why is it only over here that we allow it? Is because here it's a dire circumstance, and that's why we allow it to go through. In cases where it's not a dire circumstance, we worry about people playing games to get around the nether hana, which we'll see is a case later on in the Mishnah of the Beit Choron, an instance where a person did exactly that. They played games by trying to give it to a third party to get around the Isur Hana'ah, and then their Mishnah gives qualifications about what is considered giving it to a third party. And giving it to a third party means that the third party has the ability to do whatever they want with it. If they have the ability to do whatever they want with it, then you can get around the nether. If they can't do whatever they want with it, then you're just trying to circumvent the nether, and it's a sur. Right now, the Mishnah continues and says, what happens? Imeinei mehem acher. What happens if there's no third party with them? Miniach al ha-sela, then you put it down on a rock, or a gader, or he puts it on a fence. V'omer ein mufkarim l'chol mi shiachpots. It's hefker now. Anybody who wants can come along and take it. There's nobody for 100 miles around here beside this guy. Hefker. V'halo notel v'ochel. And the other guy goes ahead and takes it. Rabbi Yossi oser. And Rabbi Yossi says, no way, you cannot do that. He's arguing this case of hefker. He says there's no way that that works, and we'll discuss in the Gemara why he thinks that it doesn't work in this instance, but he says it definitely does not work in this case. All right, so now we had in the Mishnah, we had these three different cases, at least in the latter half of the Mishnah, which are ways to circumvent the problem of mudar hana. The first cases are cases where a third party voluntarily enters into the fray and helps out. Over there we have less issue because there's no obligation then on any party. You're not giving something to them. And they don't have any recourse against the person who told them the story. So there we're fine. In the cases over here where they're traveling and now they're trying to get around the problem, mudana, here it's much more of a precarious situation. If there are other parties there, then we ask you to go through a third party, even though that's a dangerous precedent to go through a third party. But here, because of the dire circumstances, we allow it to go through. We'll see later on in the Mishnayot, on Daf Mem Zayin, why that is not such a favorable way to go about it, and why the Mishnah on Mem Chet that says that you're not allowed to do this unless the third party really has full control over it. The last scenario, which is the most precarious of them all, is a situation when there are only two of them there. And he has to get him food. How does he get him food? He makes it hefker. He disowns the food. And by disowning it, then the other party can come and acquire it and take it for himself. So over there, the Chachamim say you're allowed to do that. Rabbi Yosef says, no way, that's too far. We're not going to allow that to happen in this instance. So now I'm a Rabbi Yochanan. My time with the Rabbi Yosef. What is the reasoning behind Rabbi Yossi's position over here that he disallows it in this instance? So he says, Kasover hefker kematana. He believes that hefker is like a gift. Ma matana da ati mirshut notein rishut mikabel. So it's like by a gift. It transfers, ownership transfers at some threshold point. One owns it, the giver owns it, and then at some point of the threshold of the kinyan, it then transfers ownership over to the recipient. So it has to go from the grantor to the recipient, and there's no in-between stage. It's grantor, recipient, and it's in either one of their possessions. Av hefker adati reshut zocheh. Says hefker works in the same way, which is that hefker, you would have thought, and this is the way that basically he's implying that the chachamim say it works, is that the person when he's mafkir the possessions is basically he relinquishes any control over it, and he makes the object ownerless. Then another party comes and acquires the object from this ownerless state and takes it into their possession. So that's the way that you normally think that hefker works. I can relinquish my control. And then someone else can come in and then exert control over the object. And in the interim, it's ownerless. What Rabbi Yossi is suggesting over here is that there's no in-between stage. It only can go from my possession into the other person's possession. When I say it's hefker, all I'm saying is that someone has a right to come and take it. It doesn't mean that it's out of my possession. It doesn't mean that I don't own it anymore. It just means that I've granted other people permission to come and take it. When they do come and take it, then it leaves my possession. But until they take it, it remains in my possession. Now that view of hefker makes it problematic to transact in this way. Or to solve the problem of mudar hanan this way. Because if the guy says, oh, this stuff is hefker, and he leaves it out on the rock. Well, it's still his, technically, until the other guy comes and takes it. When the other guy comes and takes it, it's basically as if he took it out of the possession of the grantor, the giver of the gift. And therefore, it's as if he got hanan directly from him. There's no in-between stage, or there's no ownerless stage over here. That's the way that you would explain the difference or the position here between the chachamim and Rabbi Yossi with regards to hefker. Does hefker go through an ownerless stage, which is the position of the chachamim, or does it never go through an ownerless stage? It just opens up the possibility of other people coming and acquiring it, but it remains yours until someone else actually takes it out of your possession. But then there's never a stage where it's ownerless. There are achronim that want to suggest that Rabbi Yossi's position is not as extreme as I said it, which is that there's no ownerless stage, but actually that when you have an object, when you own an object, there's different parts of your ownership over the object, which is that it's yours and you have a physical control over the object and it's yours and nobody else can take it out of your possession because it's yours. But then there may be this interim stage, which is where you relinquish control, and by relinquishing control and letting others access the object, that already takes it out of your possession somewhat, but it doesn't allow for the full transaction or the full transition of ownership until someone else picks it up. So what I described was that there's a stage where you relinquish. It goes to ownerless. And then from ownerless, it goes into the possession of the other party. Rabbi Yossi says that never happens. There's no ownerless stage. It goes from you relinquish to the other guy picking it up. What some of the Achronim describe over here is that Rabbi Yossi is not that extreme, but rather what you do is you go through stages. According to Rabbi Yossi, you relinquish control. But relinquishing control doesn't result in ownerless. It just opens it up to the public now. And the public, anybody can come and take it, including you. But you can come and take it back, or anybody can take it. Now, the finality of that transition out of your possession only takes place when someone else grabs it. But that doesn't mean until that point it wasn't somewhat out of your possession because others couldn't acquire it. So there's this interim stage, which is I relinquish control, doesn't become ownerless, but it is no longer mine. That's why other people can acquire it. But it's not fully ownerless. But then when someone else picks it up, then they finalize the removal from my possession. That only happens when the other person picks it up. So some of the Achronim describe it that way, which is it's a more subtle transition rather than the way that I describe Rabbi Yossi, which is being just this threshold line like Matana. That point is when the transition of ownership takes place. That's what the Gemara is now suggesting as the explanation for the machlokin between Rabbi Yossi and the Chachamim. So now the Gemara says, Meitiv Rabbi Abba, Vahala Notel Vochel. Then the other person takes it. Rabbi Yossi Oser, which is the Lashon of our Mishnah, but here we have it in a Braita. And the Braita has a qualification by Rabbi Yossi, which is, I'm Rabbi Yossi, Matai, Bizman She Nidro Kodem Lehefkero. That's only true when the nether precedes the Hefker. On the other hand, if it's the other way around, which is, Aval Imaya Hefkero Kodem Lenidro, if the Hefker takes place prior to the nether, Harizem Mutar, then it's totally fine. So now, if you say, basically, if this distinction is only relevant if you say that Hefker has some impact. If Hefker has an impact, then whether you took the nether before the Hefker or after the Hefker makes a difference. So in the case where you took the nether before the Hefker, then it was in your possession when you took the nether. When you're mafkir it afterwards, then we say it doesn't work. On the other hand, if you were already mafkir it beforehand, and now you take a nether, well, if it's still in your possession, the nether should cover this object. If it's already out of your possession, then the nether doesn't affect it. And that's what seemingly what Rabbi Yossi is saying over here. If it's already hefker, and then you take the nether, your nether does not impact on that object, because it's hefker, it's out of your possession. Which would not be the way that it's being explained by Rabbi Yochanan. And that's the question. Rabbi Abba's question is, I don't see that. In this way that Rabbi Yossi is describing it, the problem has nothing to do with it doesn't leave your possession until the other party grabs it, but rather, it's hefker, and it's hefker It's just like the Chachamim believe Hefker, which is you can make it ownerless. So, ho motiv la, v'ho mishani la. He asked the question, Rabbi Ava, and he answered the question himself, which is, kol anoder ein dato ma shehifkir. That yes, ein ochanami, from a law standpoint, the individual still owns the object, even after he makes it hefker, until someone else takes possession of it. On the other hand, when it comes to nidarim, nidarim have to do with what you're focused on, or what you have in mind. When a person takes a neder, he has in mind his possessions. When he already made something hefker, even though technically it's still in his possession, but in his mind it's already out of his possession, and therefore the neder doesn't cover that object. So what he says is that nidarim have to do with the mindset of the individual, not to do with the actual halacha of ownership. The actual halacha of ownership is that your ownership remains intact, according to Rabbi Yossi, until the other party comes and takes it out of your possession. On the other hand, mitzad neder, which is about mindset, in your mind, this thing's out of your possession. And when you take a neder, you're not covering that object. And that's why you get this differentiation in Rabbi Yossi's opinion. If it was hefker before you took the neder, even though technically it's in your possession, when you take the neder, you're not thinking about that object of hefker. On the other hand, if you take the nether first, and then you're mafkir the object, it's clear that you included that object in your nether. And then when you're mafkir it afterwards, that's not going to help you because it's still in your possession. Until it leaves your possession, it's in your possession. And if the other guy takes it out of your possession, then you're giving it to him directly and it's problematic. So that's how you would explain Rabbi Yossi's position under this explanation of Rabbi Yochanan. And that's how Rabbi Abba explains the qualification that Rabbi Yossi made to still reconcile with that position of Rabbi Yochanan. Meitiv Rovo, Miktzatan the Rishon, Vikulan the Sheni, Rishon Kana, Sheni Lo Kana. Okay, this is somewhat cryptic and leads to a machloket. Rashi over here explains this in one way. The Balei HaTosafot and the Rosh bring the explanation of Rashi, then bring the alternative Girsa, and the Ran goes with the alternate Girsa, which is, what is the Gemara referencing over here? And there are two possibilities as to what they're referencing. We'll go first with Rashi's explanation, which are both brought by the Rosh and the Tosafot in their first explanation of the Gemara. That the case here is a Shechiv Meira. Someone is on their deathbed, and now they're granting gifts. They grant a gift, Miktzatan Rishon. They grant a portion of their possessions to the first recipient, Vikulan Sheni, and then they grant all their possessions to the second recipient. So now, there are rules with regards to Shechiv Meira. The rules of Shechiv Meira are, when a person's on their deathbed, we allow, or the Chachamim empower them to grant gifts, even without Kinyanim, and to grant gifts without having to worry about that they're going to go through. But there are two qualifications of that. The one is that he has to give away all of his possessions. If he gives away all of his possessions, then our assumption is that the reason he's giving them away is because he thinks he's going to die. Thinks he's going to die, he didn't leave anything over. He doesn't leave anything behind because he thinks he's dying. If he grants gifts and leaves a little bit behind, that means that in the back of his mind, he thinks he may not die. If that's the case, then the gifts that he's granted are good gifts and have nothing to do with him dying. That has two ramifications or two implications. The first is that a gift from a Shechiv Meira does not require a kinyan if it's a gift of a Shechiv Meira. Number two is, if it's a gift from a Shechiv Meira, if he survives and he walks out of there healthy, then all the gifts are rescinded because he only gave the gifts because he was dying. So the way that we know that he's a Shechiv Meira is when he gives away all of his stuff, all of his property. So if he gives away all of his property, number one, you don't need a kinyan for it to be effective. And number two is, if he survives, then all those gifts are rescinded. On the other hand, if he's on his deathbed and he gives only half of his property away, then we say, number one, that's not a gift of a Shechiv Meira because he's keeping some 50% behind. Why is he keeping 50%? If he's going to die, what is he going to do with the other 50%? So it must mean that he's gifting this irrespective of his situation. So number one, that means that he's not gifting like a Shechiv Meira. You need a kinyan for it. That's number one. Number two is if he gets up from that sickness, he can't reverse the transaction because he didn't give away all the property. It means that he wasn't gifting it like a Shechiv Meira. So now, in this instance, what he does is he gives Miktzatan the Rishon, gives a portion of the property to the first party. In that case, it would not be a gift of a Shechiv Meira because he left over residually, he left the other 50% behind. And as Tosafot clarifies over here, it can't be a case where he intends to give the other 50% to the second guy because then that's the equivalent of giving away all of his property. It's a case where he only had in mind to give to the first guy and nobody else. So he gives the first guy half of his property and that's it. That's where he stops. In that case, it's not a gift of a Shechiv Meira. So number one, you would need a kinyan. But number two, if he gets healthy and he walks away from it, the first guy would keep the property and would not have to give it back. But then he changes his mind and decides he doesn't want to give anything to the first guy, and he wants to give everything to the second guy. He wants to give all of his property to the second guy. Now, in giving all of his property to the second guy, number one, that's a gift of Shchimera, so it doesn't require a kinyan. But if he survives now and walks away, the second guy gets nothing. The whole transaction is reversed. So that's the nature of the case here. Then what happens? The Gemara says, Rishon Kana, Sheni Lo Kana. In a case where this guy gets up from his sickness, the first guy is Koneh, the second guy is not Koneh. Now, what are the ramifications of that? So Rashi says over here, Rashi is an unusual sheet that's not like the Tosafot in the Rosh. Rashi says, Shmamina, Leta Dahad Rabbi Yochanan. This proves to you that Rabbi Yochanan said is not true. Da'amar lo zachi mikabel al de'ati yadei. Because Rabbi Yochanan says that the mikabel doesn't get it until it's in his hands. Meaning that the whole idea of the way that Hefker works is that it moves from the giving party to the recipient party. There's no in-between stage. So if the recipient has never gotten it, then there's no reason why you would say that it belongs to him. But that's disproved by what we just said in this case. Over here, the first guy never took possession of these objects, yet we're going to say he gets to keep them. So you see that even though it didn't go into his possession, we still deem that to be a matana, and we still deem that to be a final gift, and the first person can keep them, even though they never came into his possession. That's the way that Rashi reads this, and Rashi reads this as a question on Rabbi Yochanan's whole premise that the giver only gives up control once it goes into the recipient's hands. Over here you see that even if it didn't get the recipient's hands, it's as if the giver gave up control already. That's the way Rashi reads it. Tosafot and the Rosh, on the other hand, believe that the question here is on Rabbi Abba and not on Rabbi Yochanan. Question on Rabbi Abba, who says that, kolon oderin dato amashif kir. A person doesn't have in mind stuff that he already gave away. It's stuff that he already made hefker. Now, if that's the case, then over here, when the individual comes and gives all of his property to the second guy, what does that mean, all of his property? So David asked this before. What does it mean, all of his property? Does that mean the rest of his property? Or does that mean all of his property? Here, the Gemara says it means all of his property, including that which he gave to the first guy. So what do you see from this? That even though he gave away half of his property to the first guy, when he comes to give it away again and he changes his mind, he still has in mind property that he gave away already. So you see, that's not true. People do not forget about what they've given away if it hasn't left their possession yet. So even though he gave it to the first guy and hasn't left his possession yet, he still has it in mind when he gifts it to the second guy. Because if it wasn't the case, then when he gives the gift to the second guy, he's also giving him miksat. He's also giving him 50%. And therefore, both transactions should go through, or neither transaction go through, because he gave away all of his property. The fact that we say that the first transaction goes through and not the second one shows you that when he talked to the second guy, he was giving all his property, including what he gave to the first guy. And that shows you that a person has in mind, even things that he's given away already, but have not left his possession, he still has those in mind. And the same thing by Hefker. Even though he gave away the property, he made it ownerless, still he has that in mind when he takes the nether. So that would be the question of Rabbi Abba. That's the explanation of the Gemara according to Rashi, Tosafot and the Rosh in the first Shita. On the other Girsa, and the Ran favors this version over here, then the Gemara says, Hachi Garsinan, Meiti Brova, Miksatan Rishon, Miklan Sheni, Sheni Zacha, Lishtabebi Rishon. The second one succeeds at taking control of the first guy. This is based on a Tosefta, instead of being a Gemara in Baba Batra that discusses this issue, it's a Tosefta in Baba Batra. Tosefta in Baba Batra is talking about an individual owns two slaves. And what he does is he grants miksat of his possessions to the first slave, and then he grants all of his possessions to the second slave. So now, granting his possessions to the first slave, he only gave him miksato. If he gives miksat, there's a problem now. Because in granting only a portion of his possessions to the first slave may not take possession of himself. He's an Eved Kenani. The only way for him to become independent is he acquires himself. And by acquiring himself, he can also acquire the possessions of his master. Over here, if the master only gave him a portion of his stuff, then that first slave never takes ownership over himself, because what he left out might have been the slave himself, or portion of the slave. The first slave never takes possession. But then he grants all of his possessions to the second slave. When he grants all of his possessions to the second slave, now that second slave, first of all, acquires himself. And then when acquiring himself, he acquires all the possessions of the master, including the first slave. Because the first slave never took possession of himself. And that's what it means here, that Kulan the Sheni, Sheni Zachal Ishtabed B'Rishon. The second one takes control over the first one. Now, not only does he get all the possessions of his master and himself, but he also gets to rule over or get the first guy as his own slave. And now, what's the question? V'amart, de'en dato ma'ashi hifkir. If you say a person doesn't have in mind when he's mafkir, hachanami ain't dato mashatan kvar. Same question that the way that Tosafot and Rosh asked the question in the other version is that the Ran's asking the same question over here, and they explain it the same way, which is that the guy gave away half already. He gave away a portion. So when he gives away kula to the second one, is he really giving away all of his possessions? Or is he only giving away what's left over after he gave the first gift? The fact that Gemara says, or the Tosefta says, that he gave away everything, including what he gave to the first guy, shows you that even when he gave away something, even though it hasn't left his possession yet, he still has it in mind. He still has it in mind. That's why he granted the second one everything, including what he gave to the first guy. And that's why it's successful over here, and that's a problem for Rabbi Abba. Because here twice we brought proofs, either from the Gemara and Baba Batra, or from the Tosefta and Baba Batra, that because it hasn't left your hands yet, you still have it in mind. And therefore, when you gift it, or you're mafkir it, it has impact. All right, so that's the question, Rabbi Abba. Now the Gemara moves on, and says, El Amar Rovo, Haino Taimo de Rabbi Yossi. What is the reason behind Rabbi Yossi's position? Gzeira Mishom Matanat Beit Choron. This is what I discussed with you before. That is Gzeira Otu the Matanah Beit Choron. Matanah Beit Choron is a Mishnah coming up on Memchet that we're going to see where an individual was Mudar Hana'ah from his son. And then the son wanted to make a wedding and he wanted to invite his father to the wedding, but his father couldn't come to the wedding because he couldn't get enough from his son. So the son, what does he do? He gives all the feast and all the Suda, he gives it to a third party and says, invite my father, have everybody come. It's your Suda, it's your celebration, and therefore there's no problem. The other guy goes, if you gave it to me, I want to be Mekadeshit to Shamayim. Guy goes, I didn't give it to you to be Mekadeshit to Shamayim. I wanted you to do it for the party. Guy says, you know why? That then doesn't work. Because if you gave it to me only to get around the nether, then you guys are going to party and it's going to be my problem. The nether is going to sit on my head because I basically allowed you guys to circumvent it when it really wasn't allowed. And the problem with Beit Choron is that it only works when you grant it to a third party when the third party takes full control. But if the third party doesn't take full control, then we don't allow it to happen. So the same thing over here. Azera Mishuma Tanat Beit Choron is we don't allow you to do this hefker business because maybe the guy's not really being mafkirit. Is he really relinquishing control? Is he really giving up? Or is he just doing this to get the other guy the food? If that's the case, if he didn't really relinquish it from his control, then it's as if he's giving hana to this individual. He's facilitating giving hana to this individual. And that would be problematic in this instance. So Rashi actually brings two formulations of the Azera Mishuma Tanat Beit Choron. One is to say that the Gzeira makes it that Midrabanan, we say that this is not Hefker over here. Midoraito, it really is Hefker, and Rabbi Yossi would agree with that. The Gzeira comes along and says that we don't allow this to become Hefker in these situations to circumvent the problem of Mudar Hana'a. That's one way to formulate it. And then Rashi brings a second formulation, which is V'itim Efarshe. Elama Rav Olam Rabbi Yossi Midoraito Lo Avi Hefker. Even midoraita, it's not hefker. Ad ati l'rishut zocheh, until it reaches the other party. Below domi l'matana, and it's not similar to a gift. Umidrabanan udavi hefker. It's only hefker midrabanan, hafgav dolo ati l'rishut zocheh, until it reaches the other party's possession. Kedamrin on the command, shalot tishtakach torat hefker. That really, what it means, mishum batanat beit choron, is that the gzeira is not that it's not hefker, but the gzeira is that it is hefker. Technically, hefker is only relevant once it reaches another party's hands. And that's Rabbi Yossi Shita throughout. And that's the Din Doraita. So there is no Hefker Doraita. But the Chachamim allowed there to be Hefker Derabanan because they didn't want to be Loshi Shakak toward Hefker. For whatever reasons, they allowed it to go through and have a Din of Hefker in these circumstances. So even though generally the Chachamim allowed Hefker to go through in these instances, in this instance, they didn't let it go through because of the Gzeira Matanat, the Beit Choron. So question in Rashi is, what is Rabbi Yossi's core position? Is Rabbi Yossi's core position that, like Rabbi Yochanan, that it doesn't become hefker until the other party takes possession of it? Or is this now saying that Rabbi Yossi's core position is like the Chachamim, that it becomes hefker and there is this stage of ownerlessness, but the Gzera Chachamim made it that it won't become hefker? So that's the two shitot that are brought in Rashi over here as to what the Elo Amarova means in this instance. So that's what Rava says is the reasoning behind Rabbi Yossi's position. Tanya, a mafkir et sadeu. Person who is mafkir his field. Kol shlosha yamim yachol lachzor bo. For the first 3 days, he can back out of it. Mikan ve'elech. From then onward, ein yachol lachzor bo. He cannot retract it. So now, seemingly from this Gemara, and everybody seems to agree with this, which is that the shlosha yamim over here are, for whatever reason, we'll discuss in a second why they have this 3-day window. But what you see clearly from here is that a person is able to relinquish control of the object fully without someone else taking possession of the object. So since you can relinquish the control without someone else taking possession of the object, this is kashitat chachamim. Shitat chachamim, that you can get rid of something out of your possession, even though nobody else ever took it. So in this case, if there's no other party involved, after 3 days, the object leaves your possession, and it's no longer a question. It's not yours anymore. It's out of your possession. That is the shita of the chachamim. Now, what is this 3-day window, and how does it work? So now the Rosh has one view of this. The Rosh says that the 3-day window works like this, which is that within 3 days, if the individual comes and takes control of it because he thought it was hefker, or even if the original person who was mafkir, it takes control of it out of hefker, then it works. And it leaves his control, and the other party takes it, and that's it. It's done. On the other hand, if the person was mekaven lischot min hefker, if he didn't have kavanah to be mezochem min hefker, then the whole transaction fails. And it's as if this transaction never took place. The Ran has a more sharp distinction. He says that the transaction doesn't work no matter what. The transaction doesn't work here if anybody takes possession over the object. And the Rosh later says a similar idea over here, that the transaction will not work at all. That within the first 3 days, the transaction fails no matter what. Now, why did we do this? The reason has to do with the Gemara on tomorrow's daf, which is that we were afraid of these people who were trying to circumvent having to pay maser, or to give maser. We know that something that's hefker, produce that's hefker, is not chayav in masrot. So what these individuals were doing was they're mafkir their possessions, and then getting themselves to be patur maser, and then they reacquire it, and they take it back afterwards. So they're playing games, which is that they're mafkir it and taking it right back. So the Chachamim wanted to prevent that type of business or that type of issue. So how did they do that? They said that your hefker won't take effect until 3 days are up. That means that within 3 days, if you take repossess it, or even someone else possesses it, it doesn't work. The hefker doesn't work in the first 3 days. And that way you prevent it. And the reason they had to do that is because if they were not gozer that way, nobody else would listen to them in the other way. If they were only gozer on the party himself when he took it back, then people would say, what are you talking about? If someone else takes it, it's hefker. When I take it back, it's also hefker. So the way that they enforced their zerah was to say that no matter who takes it in the first 3 days, it doesn't work. The hefker does not work in the first 3 days. So that's a gzeirah to prevent these cheaters who were trying to get around the maser. How do they do that? They made this 3-day window. Because once you leave it out there for 3 days and then it becomes hefker, the guy's at risk. He's at a lot of risk because someone, anybody could pick it up, and now it becomes real hefker. The way these guys want to cheat is to do it quickly. They mafkir it and take it right back because then they have no risk. But now you're creating a problem of risk because you're leaving it out there for an extended period of time. And now anybody, like when he comes to pick it up after 3 days, someone else could pick it up after 3 days, and it starts to become more problematic for him. The way the Rosh formulates it is that after the 3-day period, it becomes well known, which is that the Isur Tevel is well known with regards to the Maser. The Hefker that you do is not well known. So when people can see the guy Mafkir and taking it back, they don't realize that he was Mafkir. And they're going to think the guy is not taking Masrot off or he's not doing anything with it. So what do? We want to make sure that everybody knows it's Hefker. How do you do that? You make it stay out there for 3 days, in order that everybody, the publicity about the hefker is just as public as the Isur Tevel. So that's the way the Rosh describes it. The Ran, again, I said described it before, as being an issue of getting around the problem of the Harama, that after 3 days, the Harama's gone away. But what clearly is in the case here, 3-day window is the problem of Gzeirah. But once you pass the 3-day window, the first part of the Braita is clearly speaking like the Chachamim, which is that hefker can leave your possession even without another party entering the fray. Now, the din of that Shlosh Yomim is distinct from our Mishnah, where we don't have that requirement of Shlosh Yomim. Tosafot says either because there's a difference between the case of Harama by Maaser and Metaltalim, where we don't have this Chashash of Harama, or because of what we mentioned from the Rosh before, in the name of Rav Elazar Mitz, which is that Hefker is not well known until it exists out there for a long time, but Tevo, the Easter of Tevo, is well known. And so in order to put them on an even playing field, we needed the hefker to stay out there for a longer duration. But the case of metaltalin, you don't have that issue because there's no competing issue because the mudar anah is not well known to other parties, just like the hefker is not well known to other parties. So there you have two unknowns competing against each other, and that's fine. So just like the mudar anah or this nether anah is not well known, so too when he does the hefker, even if it's not well known, that can overcome the problem. But in our case over here, where the Isur Tevel and the Maser is well known and the hefker is not well known, we need to wait for the hefker to come well known, which is that's why you have this 3-day waiting period. But Amar Teisa de Zu Mufkeret LeYom Echad, the individual says, I want this Sadeh to be hefker for 1 day, LeShabbat Echad for 1 week, LeChodesh Echad for 1 month, LeShana Echad for 1 year, LeShavua Echad for 1 Shemitah cycle, Ad Shelo Zacha Ba, if nobody takes possession of that, I mean, ben who, ben acher, whether it's him or someone else, yacholak zorbo, then he can retract it. Misha zachaba, if someone else takes possession of it, ben who, ben acher, whether it's him or someone else, and yacholak zorbo, then he can't retract it. So let's start in the abstract. In the case where he does this, the case is that if it went for a day, went for a week, or it went for a month, or a year, or 7 years, after that it would return to his possession. He can make it hefker for that period of window, and if nothing happened in the interim, or nobody took possession in the interim, it would go back to him. On the other hand, if he decides in the interim he wants to retract it, he can retract it because it did not leave his possession. Since it did not leave his possession, he can retract it at any point or any time that he wants. On the other hand, if someone comes and takes possession of it in the middle, that stops everything. That shuts everything down. If he takes possession of it in the middle, whether he takes possession or someone else takes possession of it, it shuts everything down, and then the transaction's over. But what you see from here is clearly that the issue in this instance is someone else taking control. That means that hefker is not done until someone else picks it up. This is like the Shita of Rabbi Yossi, where it goes automatically, becomes hefker, and it's ownerless. It's only shifts control or out of your control when someone else picks it up. And that's like the Shita of Rabbi Yossi. Now, even though, according to Rabbi Yossi, if the person is zochen it himself, then it never left his possession. Because the only way that the thing becomes hefker is when it transacts or moves to the other person's possession. But if the person himself takes it back, then it went from his possession back to his possession and never went through hefker. So why should that help in that situation to be poter you from the masrot? So some say that the girsa should not include the individual himself, which only be talking about other parties. On the other hand, the Ran over here suggests that the reason it works is because in that interim stage where you made it hefker and allowed other people access to it, that's enough of a reason to make it patur mi masrot. Even though it's not considered to be totally out of your possession, it's hefker enough because of the access or the rights of other people to take it, that it's patur mi maser. And then even if you reacquire it and take it back into your possession, and technically it's never really left your possession, that interim stage where it was accessible to other people is enough of a hefker to be deemed patur mi masrot. As the Ran says over here, Kevan Jeff Shala Acher Gamkin Liskopo, Achinami Kihadar Iu Gufe, Bizochibe, Beferush Mitorat Hefker, Velobistam Kechadlo Nitle Bechazara, Afhuotmo Zochemin Hefker Mikre. Since he's acting as if he's taking it from the Hefker and not from himself directly, he's not retracting the Hefker, but rather being Zoche as if it was Hefker, then he's no different than a third party that would be taking it from that Hefker state. Now, in this instance, why we're not Gozer the 3-day window like we are in the other cases? So either we have to say that there is no such gezeirah in this case, and Rabbi Yossi doesn't subscribe to that. That's one possibility. Rosh tries to show that from the fact that this case is a case of 1 day. It says mukher liyom echad. Even for 1 day you can make hefker. But Rosh comes around to this, and the Ran explains that the reason that it is in this case, it's not a problem, is because of the nature or the way that they did the hefker. The fact that the guy did this hefker over a duration, over a period of time, it shows that he's not doing this for harama. He's not doing this just to get out of the maser problem. Because if he was going to do it for the maser problem, he would just say hefker olamit and just take it back right away. The fact that he gives a duration to the hefker and all this sort of thing implies that he really intends for it to be hefker, and he's not trying to play games over here. And since this is a case where we don't think he's playing games, we're not goes there the 3-day window because we don't think he's playing games. As the Ran says over here, Ella vaday lo tol zman shifkiro gamar vifkir below harama klau. The fika. Therefore, someone else takes possession of it, it leaves his possession. If someone else does not take possession of it, it does not leave his possession. That is like the sheet of Rabbi Yossi, that hefker only works when it leaves your possession, when someone else takes possession of it. But until that point, hefker does not exist, or there's no such thing as an ownerless stage. As the Gemara says, Reisha Rabbanan, Seifa Rabbi Yossi. So the Ran reads this as a statement. The Rosh reads this as a bitmia, that Reisha Rabbanan, Seifa Rabbi Yossi. On the other hand, the Ran reads it as Reisha Rabbanan, Sefer Rabbi Yossi, and then that can't be. He says it's a statement, but the statement is problematic. Why would a Tana ever do such a thing? Why would he create a Braita that has one part that's like the Shita of the Chachamim, and one part that's the Shita of Rabbi Yossi? So now we'll give one answer to the problem, Ula's answer, and tomorrow we'll continue with Reish Lakish's answer. Amar Ula, Seifa Nami Rabbanan Hi. The Seifa is also the Shita of Rabbanan. Iachi Amai Ajalo Zachaba. Ben who, ben acher. The sheet of the Chachamim, why can't you create this state of ownerlessness of the object? Why does it have to pass to another party before it stops him from having any control over the object? So why is it that? Achlo zochaba ben hu ben acher yecholak zorbo. Says shiny shana v'shavua delo shchichi. The case of shana and shavua are not a commonplace thing. They don't happen all the time. And therefore, as the Rishonim explain over here, Rashi says, "De'ein darkam shmei adam lafkir lizman." People don't normally do efkir for a fixed duration. The kavan says this shina. This guy did something different. The kachamru hachamim to lo avi efkir lafkuya mi maser. The chamim came and intervened and said that that's not going to be good enough efkir to get rid of maser. Kozman to lo ati l'rishut zocheh until it reaches the hands of the other party. And the reason for that is, as the Rosh explains, and Tosafot says something similar, Hilka chavi hefker garua. It's a lower form of hefker. Kevin shalif kirul deolam. Since he was not mafkirit permanently, only for a duration, moder abanim bahash lo gamar b'datoshia hefker. Therefore, there's not a gemira dot that it reaches that stage of ownerlessness, achis gebo adam, until someone else takes possession of it. And the same thing is found in the Tosafot. The Ran says something similar, which is kevin deshana zeh. Since this guy did something different, amdin in the date. We assume that this is what he's thinking. Kevin shelo ratzel efkir hefker olam. Since he didn't intend for it to be completely efkir forever, vakati agid gabei, and he still has some strings attached to it. He still is pulling on it a little bit. Afilu botos manchi figol no nechalei lepik mushurte. That means that he clearly doesn't want it to leave his possession so fast and to be completely out of his possession to be ownerless. Adazaki beidach until someone else takes possession of it. Hilkach. That therefore the Chachamim believe in a hefker that is a limited hefker, I mean a limited duration, might the sphere of Rabbi Yossi be hefker olamit. They basically take up the position of Rabbi Yossi, where Rabbi Yossi says it's by all hefker, even when you do a hefker without a duration to it. The Chachamim by hefker that has a duration to it, they say that this is the case because the fact that he held onto it or he kept some residual in it shows or indicates to us that this is not real hefker. And since it's not real hefker, it won't reach that ownerless stage. It only reaches like what the Achronim said before, where he relinquishes control enough to allow others to take possession, but not complete relinquishment of control, because he can still pull it back, or until someone else takes possession of it, then it will be go into their possession. Okay, we're going to stop over here, 8 lines down on Mem Dalet Amun Aleph, and tomorrow we'll continue with Reish Lakish's answer to this problem of the Stira and the Breita, as to the Chachamim being the Tana of the Reisha and Rabbi Yossi being the Tana of the Seifa.